Good evening, saints. Happy Sabbath. It's a privilege to be with you during this convocation. We're in the last days. We believe that very much. We need to be sure our inventory is correct and our relationship with God is solid in shaking times before us. I want to share a story of my own personal experience with you tonight, not to glorify myself, but as an example of the marvelous way God is willing to work with anyone. That's all I'm trying to share. God cares about every one of us, and
we are each to have our own story. I had just turned 17 years old and 3 days when I joined the U.S. Navy. You normally think you have to be at least 18, but if one parent will sign, they can send you in. I got my mother to sign. I don't recommend this. That's awful young to go into the service. But nevertheless, that particular day for me was exciting because after 6 months in the Navy, I was assigned to ship duty, and I'll never forget the day I walked down the pier in Long Beach, California, and saw before me this huge steel vessel, the USS Frontier, and realized I was going to be part of that sailing crew in just a few days. It was a destroyer tender. That may not mean much to you, but it's the mothership that takes care of the destroyers overseas. We had a 600-man crew. It was a good-sized ship. And we were going to sail the ocean blue together. It was exciting. But Satan was there also, as he longs to influence young people, particularly at that age. So I had different buddies that I got acquainted with. We visited different ports. But the day I walked up the gangway into the USS Frontier, I wasn't thinking of those things. It was just an exciting time for me as a young man. Now, my excitement for that ship was to work in the mechanical department, the engine room, the heart of the ship, sometimes just the belly of the whale. It wasn't my preferred job, but then what could you expect a high school dropout to be assigned anyway? So I accepted it. I'd barely gotten to sleeping quarters, and putting my duffel bag of clothes away and looking over the 3 tiers of bunk beds, I got a message to report to the executive officer and the chaplain. I was not expecting that. I thought they were the people you went to when you were in trouble. So I didn't know what to think of it, but I knew I needed to get there soon. Before I tell you about that experience, I want to back up and let you know a little bit about my family, or I wouldn't have been there at 17. My father was a Norwegian. Our name wasn't Cleveland, it was Claven. But when he immigrated to this country, he made it simple. During the Depression in the early 1900s, when he was growing up as a boy in Norway, the oldest of 8 children, his father would come to America and work in the northwestern logging industry to try to get funds to support his family back at home. He promised my father that if he would hold the farm together outside of Bergen, which we still have there and family still there, that someday when he was at least 20, he'd bring him to America and he too could find a job over here. And he kept his promise. And the day came that my father came to America, my grandfather Claven got him started in the logging industry, but soon my father found his way into the business world and came to California, Northern California, met my mother at a dance, and the last day that my grandfather stayed in America was the day my parents got married. And he left on the ship to go back to Norway. And he didn't return again. The economy began to improve, and my father was able to send money as well. In time, my father in the business world became employed with Sears and Roebuck, which was the premier company at that time, well before Walmart. You could buy everything through Sears catalog. Some of you remember that? I was second born. I had two sisters, one 3 years older and one 3 years younger. And I was born in Berkeley, California. Can any good thing come out of Berkeley? My dad was the department manager for Sears and Roebuck, and we became pretty comfortable there in the Bay Area. We were a Sunday-going church family, but it wasn't for the right reasons. My father thought, as an immigrant and a good American, you just go to church because that's what American people do. But you know, it was when you don't practice your religion, you damage young people who are watching on. You know, we'd go to church on Sundays, but it was an argument in the car on the way and one on the way home. We never even said grace at a meal. I don't think my father owned a Bible. But that's just the way it was. That's what we grew up with. We weren't a happy family, and so I compensated not having a brother. My bike was my best friend. My paper route kept me busy. I was a busy boy mowing lawns and all kinds of things. I liked to work, but I needed to be more on my own. I didn't realize some things that were happening in my home. My two sisters suffered sexual abuse all their growing up days. We just didn't talk to each other about those things. We weren't a close family. When I was 15, I got a job on a farm in Colorado. Took the train and headed out to work with an old couple that had a farm and sheep and a lot of haying to do in the summertime. And I really enjoyed helping. The lady, Mrs. Weimer, was a great cook. She made homemade bread, and it was just a relief to get out of the city and be in the country and take care of the sheep and help to bale hay and put it up and so forth. One day when I was working, there was another young couple that came, a young man, a younger married man came. Dan was 26 at the time, as I remember. And Mr. Weimer was old enough, he really couldn't handle all his hay, and so he had agreed, as often farmers do, if you'll put up the hay, you can have half of it, put it up mine, and you can have the rest. And so Dan came over and was a very positive person, and I really enjoyed working with him. And so we were several weeks in haying together. And it was during that time, late in that summer, I received a letter from my mother telling me that she was divorcing my father, leaving California and moving to Oregon, taking my younger sister. My older one had gotten married and left the home just before I went to Colorado. I knew, of course, there was a lot of tension in our home. I knew the talk of divorce had come up before. Somehow, I just wasn't expecting it there. And when the news came, it hit me pretty hard, of course, as a young man, 15 and a half years old. And I was angry. I didn't know all the background. If I'd known the background, perhaps, you know, I would have understood it should have happened sooner. But for me, from my point of view, I knew I couldn't go back to California to live by my father. I was angry with my mother because I didn't really understand the whole situation. And suddenly, I was without a home, in my opinion. Dan stepped in at that time, this other man that had the farm nearby, and he said, you know what, if you aren't going home and you need a place to stay, I'm talked to Betty and our kids, and we'd like to have you come stay with us. We can't pay you, but we can give you room and board. And I liked this family. They had four little kids, 4, 5, and 7, and I was 15. So I said, yeah. And I joined the family. I went to the high school there out of Grand Junction, Colorado for that year, part of that year. And it was really good to be in a home where there wasn't arguing. In fact, they seemed happy somehow. And it was just refreshing for me. More than that, as I was struggling with my history and my background and the feelings I had towards my parents, it was good to have their influence where they would bring out things to me that at least brought the most positive parts of what they observed with my parents as they would see letters come or a birthday gift I was remembered. And in some ways, my parents were responsible and they were caring individually, even though from different points, California and Oregon. But it got me thinking about kind of giving them another chance and trying to look at the best of them. And you know, we have to do that. I mean, life in general is not that easy for almost any of us. You know, more homes break up today in America than stay together. So there's a lot of hurting young people out there and hurting people. So my attitude towards them improved. At Christmas time, I went and visited them. And we made the best of it. I went to school that year, and when I turned 16, because of my paper route, I'd saved some money. And on my 16th birthday, I not only had my driver's license, I had my second car. That's great for a boy. In a farming community, there aren't boys with cars. But I had my car. The problem is, I got new friends. Can you imagine? And the problem was they weren't the best friends. They were the dance friends and the fights friends and the drinking friends. Dan tried to help me. He tried to urge me to get home from school quicker because I was supposed to be helping on the farm, and I did. But he could see I was being pulled more into town and lingering. His approach wasn't the best, but as I look back, I can see he was really trying to save me from getting into a bad crowd, because I hadn't been in a bad crowd. When he did that, Satan was right there. These folks are just trying to control you. They just want your work. They don't really care about you. And I began to think about that. And I thought, you know what? Maybe that's true. And I like my car. And what's wrong with some friends? And so it was a real struggle for me. But I also realized I was getting an ultimatum. Either I needed to change this association, be at home quicker, or I needed to move on. I took that as a real negative thing. And I thought, you know, if you don't really want me here, I can do it my own way. And I left. I didn't go far. I still stayed in school. I went 9 or 10 miles over to the town that I was going to school, got a job at the Rail Cafe for 90 cents an hour and one meal a day. And my car became my home. But winter was coming on. It was not an easy winter, I can tell you. But I was a proud boy, and I was a hardworking boy. And I thought I'd been misunderstood. So I toughed it out that winter. Nights I felt like I would freeze, have to start the car and warm it up and get warm up for a while, but afraid to leave the engine running, and have to shut it off and try to snuggle up again and sleep in that car, and go to school the next day, work at the Rail Cafe, get that one meal. It wasn't the best. I won't recommend that program. Can you imagine why I was anxious to join the Navy at the end of that year? 3 meals a day, yeah. And sail the ocean blue and wear that nice uniform. So I didn't even finish that school year. It was rough. I was a junior in high school at that time, but when spring came and that weather warmed up and things just were not easy for me. And I'd gotten in some situations with some of those kids in town, and I said, you know, I really don't want to go the way they're going. God was working on my heart. I couldn't label it then. But I didn't feel comfortable with their lifestyle and the mentality that they had. So I wanted to just get away, but where? So I headed out to Oregon where my mother was living. She'd remarried by now, and God blessed her with a very kindly person, as a husband. And he was taking good care of my mother, and my sister was still living with them. And convinced her to help sign for me to get into the Navy. Well, I was sent to San Diego, California for a boot camp, and I tell you what, I loved the Navy. It just sat well for about 2 weeks. And then I realized I was in trouble because I'd signed the contract for 4 years. And now I knew I was in high school. But I'm not a quitter. And so I tried to make the best of it, but I realized it wasn't going to just be a piece of cake. God is so good to us. I think of Proverbs 3. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction, for whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth. And I needed that. I needed his gentle, loving, caring hand. So after 7 months, I was assigned sea duty. It was exciting to be part of this big ship, and yet, why do I have to report to the executive officer? I know I'm supposed to work. I've got my bunk assignment, but I better get up there. So I saw the chaplain first. He was very warm and friendly. He offered me a Bible. I wasn't expecting that. And a study book, Haley's Handbook. And out of courtesy, I took it. I knew I wasn't going to be reading it. I just wasn't negative against God. But I was there to sail the ocean blue. What's this got to do with it? But I took it anyway. Then I met the executive officer. This ship had to be different. I can't believe that all the ships do it this way. But this executive officer was very fatherly. And he welcomed me to the ship, and it turns out that he was trying to interview the new people coming on board. A number of the guys were already on a previous tour, but the new ones, he was just getting acquainted with them somehow. And he welcomed me, and he looked at my papers, and he said, I see you're assigned to the engine room. And he said, are you looking forward to that? And my body language betrayed me, and he sensed that, and I was, you know, I was planning on it, but it wasn't what I really had asked for. And he dug a little deeper. And I said, well, sir, you know, when they asked me back in boot camp what I wanted to do, I told them I wanted to be a medic. But when they gave me the aptitude test, I scored high in the practicals. And they said, you know, it's not going to work. We can't assign you to the medics. So I accepted that. I understood that, you know, I'm a high school dropout. I'm going to fit in to do the best I can. So they just said, you can learn on the ship if you don't want to go to school. In my little teenage mind, I thought, you know, if I accepted machinist mate school, I will never get to be a medic. So I'll just go on as a striker, what they called it, and I'll learn on the job, and maybe somehow this dream would come true. Don't know why I really thought that. I mean, the military just doesn't work that way. But he asked me, and so I told him that story, and I said, you know, my aunt's a nurse. My mother was becoming a nurse. My two sisters became nurses. God knew I was going to marry a nurse. Why shouldn't I be a medic? But they didn't know that. And he stopped and he said, that's interesting. He said, come with me. I thought, oh my, what have I done now? So we went on down a couple of layers and we headed up this long hallway, and I looked up there at the end of the hall and I saw a sign. I couldn't believe it. Sick bay. I said, you're kidding. They're taking me to be a medic? Just like that? And we got up the hallway, and just before we got to that door, he stopped, and there was a door to the right. And it said, dental clinic. And I thought, and he opened the door, and I thought, oh, there's a mistake. What am I doing here? I hate dentists. I mean, as a paper boy, I had I had pocket change all the time. I was bubblegum and candy and milkshakes, and I knew Dennis because of it. And for me to be offered to work in the dental office, well, you know, 17-year-olds aren't too smart. But all of a sudden, I got to thinking about it. White uniform, air-conditioned, easy hours, nothing between cruises, compared to the bilges of the engine room. I think I'll volunteer. As they explained to me, they were short-handed. And if I was willing to do the job, and if I was faithful, I could even be recommended for school when we got back, about a year later. I signed up and joined the dental department. And I really enjoyed it. It turned out to be a real blessing. And that was an encouragement to me. God works marvelously. He wasn't just trying to help me out of the bilges. He provided me an opportunity and an atmosphere that was more lifting, working with the officer one by one, working with a small crew within the office. But that Bible the chaplain gave me, to a miracle to this day, I can't even remember the first day I began to read it, but after I did, it drew me in with the power of the Word very quickly. And the only time we were really busy in the dental department would be at every port. But those weeks between ports, sailing the ocean in the Pacific, we were free unless there was an emergency. We just had to be findable, which is not too hard to do on a ship. And so the guys would scatter and do what they want. I had the whole office to myself, and I often was there reading the scriptures and studying that little handbook and trying to understand it. God gave me a friend on the ship and in my department in the same situation, Lee Manley, who also was a striker. He was invited to join as well, like I was, the two of us. The rest of them had been trained. And he had a Christian background, more practical than mine, more practiced than mine. And it was really a blessing. Oh, he had his struggles. We had our temptations in some ports. But we also had some tremendous experiences. I remember like in the Philippines. I mean, Subic Bay is the pits for sailors. I mean, there's nothing uplifting. I mean, the government helps make alcohol cheap for young people. If you drink on the base, you get it for 10 cents a glass. And so it's easy for young people to be led astray. Lee and I didn't do much with that kind of stuff, fortunately. And there in the Philippines, in Subic Bay, it was a Christian group that had had a burden to have a little outpost to welcome servicemen, generally sailors, that you could just come there and have a hamburger and play some Christian music and be encouraged to write letters home, and so forth. They just encourage you to be part of your family. Don't get disconnected while you're over here. And they would pray with you. And everywhere I went, from port to port, there was always some kind of encounter where God was trying to speak to me. And I really appreciated those people, that they were so warm and kind and inviting. Then we got to Hong Kong, and our ship was anchored out there, and it was impressive to see a port in which we were mingling with ships that often were considered our enemy, because Hong Kong was the crossroads of the world for shipping industry. And so there we were for some days for R&R, rest and recreation. And we had something strange happen. For the first time in this cruise, we had women come aboard our ship at mealtime and meet us in at the end of the chow line, as we called it, when we went to finish our meal and took our trays out. And these women were methodically taking our tray, and if we had anything left over, peas went in this bucket, leftover scraps of meat in that bucket, something else in this bucket, and they sorted it. And I thought, whoa, this is different. Civilians on the ship, you know, and foreigners, but they had a special contract. And we saw the rest of the contract. If you went outside during the day, here was the men on rafts with huge long poles and paint rollers, and they were painting our ship for us in exchange for our garbage. Because there were so many refugees on the hills of Hong Kong at that time, living under cardboard and tin, that they were trying to support and feed themselves. And the Navy allowed them to collect our garbage to do that. And I thought to myself, what is this world coming to that this has to be done this way? And even though it's a strange set of circumstances, that actually probably was the first thing that happened to me that got me into asking the Bible, are there answers to these kinds of questions? Why is it some of us have it so good in comparison to those that live like they're living? By the time our ship was due to come back to America, I had had enough of these kinds of experiences that I decided that when I came back to this country, I want to find a church. I'll tell you one more experience that I'll come back to another time tomorrow. When we got to Japan, we went to three different ports in Japan over a period of time. And in one port, we were there on a weekend. And by this time, I had gotten to know a few of the men on the ship that were into spiritual things. I mean, out of 600 men, if you went to the library on Sunday for church service, there could be 12 of us. It wasn't a big thing. But they noticed that I was interested. They had gone on shore on Sunday on leave and came back after lunch just excited of what happened at church that day in Osaka, no, in Kobe, and said that they had an invitation to go to a girls' school this evening for supper and want to know if I'd like to come. And that the girls invited them were American girls and that were teachers at this school. Well, of course we wanted to go. I mean, you know, for cultural reasons, to see your own people. After you're overseas a while, you like to see your own people. And I said, yes, I want to go. So we got together and we went there. And there were six of us guys and there were six of those girls. And these girls were dedicated Christian women who were teaching in that private school. There was nothing out of line in our whole visit. And as they took us around this beautiful campus, the Japanese people, you know, are very educational oriented. They push their kids. They have a high suicide rate of children because a lot of kids, if they don't do well, they just, you know, it's over with. So they were on this campus, beautiful flowers and paths, and we kind of paired up together with each of us with a girl, just talking and listening about the school. They asked us some about what we were doing, but it was all very wholesome. In my mind, it was both my request and almost like the Lord had said, but mostly my request. As I walked with this one woman, I don't even remember her name now, but my age, she was a little older than me, but not much. And I said to myself, someday I want to marry a girl like this. I never forgot that prayer. It was like a prayer. But God didn't forget it either. That's what's so good about God. So when we came back to the States, after most of a year overseas, I tried to find a church. I went back to the Methodist church, which I had grown up just attending in a social way. I had a bad experience. Not a big deal. But I knew I wasn't going to go back there. It just didn't fit. I went to a Catholic church. I went to Mass. Pretty soon I ended up studying with some Mormon missionaries. I'd never heard of Adventist at this time. But then I met my first Adventist. At the same time, I was having Bible studies with the Mormons. The man that I met, today I don't think he's even a Seventh-day Adventist. But God used him to notice my interest in spiritual things and offer to put me in touch with someone that would give me, answer some questions. And he put me in touch with a retired chiropractor that was a man of God. Even if you just looked at him, he had the peace of Jesus in him. And we began to study. Him on Thursdays, the Mormons on Tuesdays. When the Mormons found out I was studying with those Adventists, they were pretty upset. They brought all the bad information you can think of about Adventists and about Ellen White and really tried to discourage me. Every question they would raise, I would take it right to Dr. Brenniger. I said, they said this, and they said this. And he'd say, okay, well, that's a good question. Let's just open the Bible. And he would always open the Bible, and he would answer every question. And the little Mormon boys didn't do that. They raised questions, but they didn't answer them very well. And in a little bit of time, I realized that until the Lord would lead otherwise, I wanted to continue with the Seventh-day Adventists. There were two other guys that were in the military, in the Navy at the time, too. We all three started with Dr. Brenniger. But in a few weeks' time, they dropped out, and it almost pulled me out. The devil does everything he can to sidetrack us. Dr. Brenniger looked at me like, well, I mean, he almost looked like he assumed I was going to quit, too, because these other two did. And I said, no, I mean, if it isn't too much trouble, I want to continue. No, it's not too much trouble. Of course, he reassured me, and we continued to study. Every single week for 6 months, I had a wonderful Christian mentor. And at 6 months, I asked for baptism before he could ask me. And I was looking forward to it so much. I was still in the Navy. He'd come out and he would study with me every Thursday. I was really, really happy. It was a wonderful experience. I had found a new family. When I was baptized that day, the day I was baptized, there was a woman there, an older woman, of course, when I tell the story. And as we were in a receiving line afterwards, there was another young man that was baptized when I was. And the two of us were in line, and church members came by, and were shaking our hands and hugging us and so forth. And this lady said something to me I would never forget. She said, oh, young man, it's so good to see people like you baptized. It just thrills my heart. But I suppose, like so many of them, you'll cool off in a few years, and we might not even see you. And I thought, whoa, what did she say? I mean, does she know who she's talking to? I mean, I'm Peter. No way, never me. You can all deserve, but I'm not going to. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I was on fire for God. I didn't know what was going to happen at the base when I, you know, would come to a Sabbath problem. I'd been keeping Sabbath by the time I was baptized at least 3 months. But I had Sabbath duties that came up. And I had to work them out. I had to find a way to be excused from them by trading with somebody else. And it had worked so far, but I didn't know if there was a guarantee that would continue. So when I was baptized, to have her say that, she just didn't understand. And it was very sad that she said it. But I won't forget it. And I thought of it again from time to time. So the Lord allowed things to go well for me after my baptism there on the base, for about 6 months. On Saturdays, we would spend the mornings doing routine dental work. I was the dental technician, so I was assisting the dentist with the fillings. We used to talk about drill, spit, and fill. And it was routine work. On Sunday, we were free to do whatever. We were just there for emergency. So I tried to find guys that I could trade with and cover for them on Sunday if they'd cover for me on Saturday. And all you had to do is sign a little paper to show that he's agreed and that you're willing, turn it to the office, and it's a done deal. I mean, they had to prove it, but they always did, until 6 months was up. And then they sent the request back disproved, unapproved. I was surprised. In fact, I learned that two of my buddies had been given approval to be off on Saturday for a party. I thought, well, if they can let them off, there's no inspection coming, why didn't they let me off? So I went to the office and I asked to speak to them about it, and I found that they were very nonchalant but firm that I would be there that Saturday for duty. Well, I thought somehow they just didn't understand. So I asked permission to see the captain, a full captain of the dental department. They said, sure, you can see him, no hesitation. They led me into his office. It was like he was expecting me. I explained to him my desire to just exchange duty. He treated me like I was trying to get out of duty, you know, like I'm asking to be exempted from even taking my turn when I'd actually just traded with someone. And he shook his finger at me and he said, Cleveland, even I come in to work on my holy day and you're going to work on yours. And he had they had made a decision to just force me. Why? I don't really understand, except if you know the devil, that explains it. There was no reason, but it was just they were going to humble me into service. It's a shame that that happens, but that was the situation. I didn't know what to do, but I wasn't afraid. Somehow, all through what happens in the next few days, God is there with you. All his biddings are enabling. And all I knew was I was going to honor the Sabbath. So that afternoon when I finished at the office, I called a civilian chaplain that I knew from church. We didn't have an Adventist chaplain on the base. We did over at the Naval Training Center, but by this time, I had gone through the dental technician school and had been assigned with the Marine Corps in the U.S. Marine Corps Naval Training Center there in San Diego as well. The Marine Corps is a branch of the Navy. They love us to remind us of them of that. There's only the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy, and Marine Corps is a division of the Navy. You want to make a Marine mad, just tell them that. And anyway, so they don't have any medical staff. All medical personnel for the Marine Corps are Navy. That's why. So we were stationed with them. So all the dental clinic were Navy men taking care of the recruits. So there was no Adventist chaplain on our base. So I called Elder Gant, who was a civilian chaplain, and told him my situation. He said, be sure to follow the chain of command. You need to go and ask for help from those on the base. He says, there's chaplains there, they're not Adventists, but choose one of them and ask them to help you. That's step number one. I said, okay, I'll do that. This was early in the week. So I went to the chaplains, and there were three of them. An Episcopalian, I didn't know what that was, I couldn't even spell it, I never even heard of it. I didn't think that fit. Then there was the Catholic priest, I said, no, I don't think so. And then there was a Methodist, I thought, well, I know those fellas. And so I went to see him, and I explained my situation to him, and as I talked to him, he looked like he was angry. And he listened and let me finish. And then he got his big black book out, but it wasn't the Bible. It was the Code of Military Justice. And he said to me, without explaining the reason at all, he said to me, if you insist on this pushing for being off on Saturday, he says, I will join them in throwing the book at you. I thought, whoa, what is all this about? You know, I was so surprised to see him take that position. It's contrary to what a chaplain's code is. I've always wondered if somehow he could have known I was coming. It just was so reactionary. And he even showed me in the huge book where this might fit, that I was disobeying an order and that I would be court-martialed and put in prison. He's telling me this. So that evening, when I was done at the office, I called Elder Gant back and I told him the situation. And he said, just take it one day at a time. And that day, I'd also received notice that I was to report on Thursday morning to the colonel, the Marine colonel, in the legal department. And so Elder Gant says, look, I'll be praying for you. And you know that many of us are praying for you. God's going to see you through. So just go and listen and answer their questions. So that next day, I reported to the legal office, and the colonel invited me in. It was just him and I, except for his secretary in the office. And he began to talk to me about the situation and asked me questions about my faith and my motives. But when I tried to answer his questions, he would always come up with another one and never really let me finish. And it was almost like he was trying to frustrate me. Somewhere after 5 or 10 minutes, he came in. There was a knock on the door. And guess who joined us? The chaplain. Who told him I was going to be there? I don't know. So the colonel continued to question me for a while. And in my sharing, eventually the colonel kind of ran out of his list of questions and finally just sort of let me share in my own words He said, why do you think you deserve this special kind of treatment? And I said to him, sir, I said, I'm only asking to trade, that I'm more than willing to carry my share. I said, before I gave my heart to Jesus, I said I was into drinking and smoking and honestly, I came to work and did as little as possible, and when it was over, I got out as quick. I said, but since I've given my heart to Jesus, I come to work early, I stay late. I said, you look at my scores, my records. I said, today the military has twice the person they had before. I just spilled it all out to him. And I saw the chaplain kind of wiggling in his chair and looking, scowling at me, and finally, he said to the colonel, can I ask Cleveland a question? And the colonel said, yes. And he said to me a very confusing question. And he said, Cleveland, he said, all this talk about giving your heart to Jesus, and yet you grew up in a church atmosphere, and he was trying to make me look hypocritical, as far as I could understand, in his question. And to be honest with you, I never understood his full question, and I never really got to even try to answer it. Because at that point, the Lord took over 100%. I don't know if you've ever had your mouth used by someone else, but my mouth began to answer things I didn't even think about. And it was an awesome moment. I would have never done it. But in his asking me that question, I tried a little bit to answer, and then the Lord took over. And next thing I know, I said to the colonel, sir, may I ask the chaplain a question? And he said, okay. And I turned to the chaplain and I said, sir, no, I didn't say, my mouth said, sir, do you smoke? And they both stopped breathing, and so did I. And it was dead silent. And the man turned, his face was red and green, and he squirmed. And the colonel looked at him as if to say, well, He didn't say it, but you could see it. And finally, the man admitted that he was a smoker too. I wasn't now, but he admitted it. And just when that happened, there was tremendous tension. The phone rang, and we all jumped. It was that bad. And the colonel answered the phone and said, "Excuse me a moment," and he told me to leave. And I went outside for 5 or 10 minutes. Oh, I didn't know what was going to happen. I said, "Why did that ever happen?" I sensed God did it, but I didn't know if it's going to make it worse or better. I really couldn't reason about it. It was just beyond me. They called me back in, and they said, "Cleveland, you've taken enough of our time." I never asked for any. "You've taken enough of our time." He said, "From now on, when your duty comes up on Saturday, it's going to automatically be changed to Sunday. Do you understand?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "So this week, your duty, we will arrange to be changed to Sunday. Do you understand?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, is there anything else you need?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well then, son, you're dismissed. You can go, and it's all going to be worked out." I said, "Yes, sir." And I went out, floating out of that office, floated across that parade ground. All those poor recruits being yelled at by the sergeants, you know, marching. And when I had walked across that parade ground that morning on the way to the office, the devil said, "See all these guys out here? They know how to obey orders. You're going to go to prison." He talked to me, tried to talk to me as I walked across that huge parade ground alone. But God was there with me, and I wasn't fearful. And so I just went to the office not knowing what was going to happen. Now I'm coming back across. I don't understand it. I can't wait to tell somebody. The office back at home wasn't, you know, the dental office people, they had pressured me to, even my own dentist had said to me, who was a Catholic, "You need to talk to your priest. You know, don't do this to yourself. You're going to get in big trouble." He was trying to help me, and that's how he would have handled it. I said, "Commander Brower, I can't do that. Priests can't give me permission to go against God's commandment." I said, "You know, I'm just trying to trade. I'll do my duty." He says, "You're heading for big trouble." That's all he could tell me. But now he came back, and I couldn't wait to call Elder Gant. So after office finished that day, I called him up, and I was telling him the story of what had happened. And I noticed eventually he began to say, "I know, I know, I know." I said, "What do you mean you know? How did you know?" He says, "Because when you went over there, I came to the base and made an appointment with the commanding general. And I explained to him who you were, what was happening. And he said, my experience with Seventh-day Adventists has generally been positive. If you're telling me that this young man is faithful to his church, has been faithful to duty, I will see that he gets his Sabbath." And he was a telephone call that came during our exchange. And he told the colonel I would have Sabbaths and to work it out. Well, you know, you could say that's the end of the story. But when you go over the heads of your officers in the department, they were not happy campers. They were very upset. And I was there alone. There was no one else to talk to about this. But I could see they were very unhappy. I mean, Satan had inspired them to do this. There was no real reason to do it. But from that point on, they tried for a number of months to break me, to cause me to stumble. Sure, they respected the order, and I came in on Sunday. On Sundays, there was nothing to do but just be on the base. You could even go to movies, which I didn't do anymore. But you just had to be available. But when I came to work on Sunday, oh no, Cleveland, little note on the desk, "You need to do this, this, and this." They had me on my knees, which was fine. I don't know if you've ever painted baseboards in a huge military base. when there's miles of them. But they had me paint the baseboards on my knees every Sunday. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of painting a dark room over again, a black dark room where you develop the x-rays that's black to paint it black again. It's really exciting, I'll tell you. And I was there one time doing this, you know, on another Sunday, and I was tempted for a little pity party that this is discrimination, this isn't really fair. I didn't go there very often, but that day I remember I got caught doing that in my own heart. And the Lord says, look it, you have what counts. You have the Sabbaths. I'll take care of the rest later. You just do your best. And I determined to never complain. Never complain. When I became an Adventist, I was not even living on the base. I'd gotten an apartment in Chula Vista, California. It was so good to get off the base at night and just be out of that atmosphere. I started working at Paradise Valley Hospital, one of our hospitals near San Diego. And that was like heaven for me. Those nurses, I was just working as an orderly. But as I would get off the base at 3 p.m, I would get out there as quick as I could and join the evening shift. And they said, don't worry, you know, you're a little late, it's okay, we're going to work with you. And those nurses, like, they mothered me, you know. They gave me books and cookies and, you know, all kinds of encouragement. And it was just like I'd gained a new family. It was just precious to me. And so it was just a little heaven. But then the base said, you know what, you're not married. And according to the fine print, you're not entitled to live offshore, as we called it. And so we want you back in the barracks. Oh, I only have a few more months. Why would this have to happen? But anyway, I had a roommate that I was sharing the apartment with, and he was getting married, and he had trouble finding an apartment for themselves to move into, and he'd actually, just about that time, approached me if I'd be willing to turn the apartment over to them. And then I got invited back to the base to stay. And I thought, oh, they'll be throwing boots at me when I pray, and they're swearing, and the TV, and... So I moved back into the base. I moved back into the barracks. No one ever threw a boot at me when I prayed. If they swore, they stopped, because I never noticed it. I mean, God is with you in whatever happens. He guides you. And so those last months, little by little, the Sunday assignments stopped. Little by little, I could see that they accepted me for having something real. And it was such a blessing to know that. Even my Catholic dentist said to me, if I would sign up for 2 more years, he'd take me with him. He was being transferred to Hawaii. He says, surely you'd want to go. And I said, Commander, I love working with you, but I couldn't do that and risk the Sabbath situation again. And he understood. When I was getting ready for discharge, I had to have a physical, blood work, and a follow-up on that. It was an interesting time. I didn't know a lot about the health message, but by God's grace, I had gotten a wonderful mentor besides Elder Gant and Dr. Brenniger. Another family had kind of adopted me and coached me through several things I'll tell you more about tomorrow. And in their influence, I had made a decision to become a vegetarian. And so I had had at least 6 months on the base as a vegetarian. And even in the 60s, if you can picture that far back, by the way, we had a salad bar on the base. And when I'd go through the mess line, the guys soon noticed I didn't take the meat. And they would come up to me and say, well, if you'll take the meat, I'll give you my potatoes. I love potatoes. Anyway, so there was lots of ways it all worked out very reasonably. But when I had that physical and I came in, I'll always remember what a blessing it was to me. He said, the doctor said to me as he looked at my lab report, he says, Cleveland, he said, you have got to have the lowest cholesterol of anyone on this base of 10,000 people. And I had the joy of explaining to him that I didn't eat cholesterol-laden foods, and that made a difference. Finally, I remember some of the fellows saying to me on my last couple of days there, we don't know much about Seventh-day Adventists, but whatever they have must be fairly powerful because we've watched what it did for you. That was such a blessing. When I left the Navy, I continued to work at Paradise Valley for a while, and I wanted to go to an Adventist school. And the Jensens that were my spiritual mentors had been a great help to me, and eventually they influenced me to go to the Mother College. I had visited the California schools, and I just wasn't ready for that. There were some real challenges, even in the 60s. So I ended up going back to Andrews University, which was Emmanuel Missionary College just before then. And I want to just take a few minutes to close with these thoughts. I want to go back to the little lady that told me what it's like with a lot of people going out the back door. I got to Andrews University, and there, as a theology student, I had wanted to go into medicine originally, but even though I worked at the hospital, I worked in surgery, and I had that pre-medical background, the Lord eventually just kept speaking to me about going into the ministry. It took me quite a while to accept that. I'll tell you more about that tomorrow. But as I got back to Andrews University, I got involved in the campus, and I was very active on campus. In fact, I helped organize the first public evangelistic series that had ever been held in the Pioneer Memorial Church, where we invited the public to come, and God blessed. I was active in the Student Association. I was chaplain, and I had a really good experience. I had some very good teachers. I worked with the conference. I helped raise up a church in Stevensville. I led a whole group of young people out there, and we'd go every weekend, door to door. And we had a lot of Bible studies. In the summer, we had so many Bible studies, the conference hired me as a Bible worker each year. So I was very involved. When I graduated, I had 3 calls into the ministry, which was a privilege. Some guys didn't get any. But all of them were via the seminary. I was raring to get out in the field. I'd already been in the field as a Bible worker. But they wanted me to go through the seminary. So I went 2 more years. That was really, really rough. To have me in school those many years after being a high school dropout. I made it through college fine, but I loved just the practical aspects of being out in the field. By the time I had 2 more years of study, I was burned out. I was really burned out. And I was fearful of starting the ministry. Because I'd been so active in the Michigan Conference, they didn't even offer me an internship. They said, the day you graduate, here's the key to 2 churches. And they sent me out on my own. I became the King of the North in Michigan, up in Lake Superior, in the Upper Peninsula, and had 4 marvelous years up there. But I went there, tempted to quit the ministry. It was that bad. Yet I didn't know who to talk to. Who would understand what I was going through? Hear all that training. Too much. And some of it just too theoretical. And now to face those 2 churches, to hold communion services for them, to preach to them when I'm struggling for my own survival. I'm married, I have 2 children. And that little lady's comment would come back to my mind from time to time. Oh, every morning I'd go downstairs in the parsonage and I'd wrestle with God and I'd plead with God to give me back my first love. I didn't want to be a hypocrite. I didn't want to be a mechanical pastor. I wanted to give him the real thing that I used to have, but I didn't have it for a while. It's strange how it came finally. I was at a workers' meeting in Lansing in wintertime. And we went out to a Chinese restaurant for dinner. But I was still struggling with this situation. 6 months had gone on, and I hadn't had that answer. And I remember getting my food, and I didn't even want to eat with the fellas. I just took a takeout container and went back to my motel room, and I put my food down. I never like to miss a meal. But this was so bad. And I just got on the knees on my linoleum floor, and I said, Lord, here I'm at workers' meeting, and I still, you've not answered this prayer. And I pled with him. And that night, that dreary motel room lit up like a sanctuary. And God, I can't even tell you how I knew, except I knew it was settled. He had come back in my life in a special way and gave me that first love anew and fresh. I want to mention that to you because there are too many of us that can come into the church and end up going out the back door in one way or another. You understand that, don't you? It's just risky. There's so many young people that come in that don't stay in. And I'm just thinking of where we are today. Why? I ask myself once in a while in gratitude, I say, Lord, why am I so fortunate to have even learned about Seventh-day Adventists the way I did? Learned about it from a man who didn't even stay in the church, but was just there long enough to put me in touch with somebody that could carry me through. Why do I be so fortunate? When I walk down the street, whether it be in New York City when we used to have the restaurant work and I was involved with that for a while, and I see those thousands of people and I think, why am I so fortunate and so few of these people have this knowledge? Or in the town that I live in now, a small town, Dunlap, Tennessee. So I'm trying to reach out to my community. Why are we so fortunate? Why are you so fortunate? Here we are so close to the promised land. How is your experience with God? Do you still have that first love experience? We have to ask ourselves. When December 2016 came a few months ago, I was praying as I do every morning. And I was saying, Lord, you have blessed me and you've helped me to keep my love. And I want to do inventory. Am I doing what you want me to do? Is there something I should do? I'm getting older. I only have so much more to give to you. Am I on target? Am I where you want me to be? Is there anything I should adjust this year? Did you do that at the end of the year? When's the last time you've done that? We need to take our temperature. We need to check in with God. And so I'm the head elder of my church. I have a wonderful church. And I came to the elders and our pastor in our meeting, our monthly meeting. I said, you know, guys, what can we do for Dunlap? Think of the time that we're in. You all agree we're in the last days. Are we going to do something different in our church this year compared to last year? Or are we going to be just happy to go along with our happy way of doing things? Sure, we have peace in our church. Sure, we have fellowship dinner every week for guests. Sure, we're doing a lot of good things. Yes, I have dinner for the doctor program every month. Yes, we're doing outreach. But is there something different? And I challenged them. Why don't we start a prayer group? Why don't we have a prayer group in the church? Some of us, every Sabbath morning, before the church members even come, what was the name we used? Anyway, let's lift up Christ somehow. Let's come early. I mean, you know how it is Sabbath morning. You're just rushing to get there for Sabbath school. And I said to my wife, I said, you know, let's bump it up an hour. Let's get there an hour early. You know, it was just a decision. All we had to do is just make the decision. We're going to be there at 8 o'clock, not 9 o'clock. And once we made the decision, it was easy. And so we began a prayer band. And every Sabbath morning we'd come. And a small group would come. And we would hold up the church service, and we'd hold up the Sabbath school. We'd pray for the pastor, and it's drawn us close together. I'm just giving an example. You don't keep your first love by accident. We need to be thinking about it. You know, when a national disaster comes, it's not if, it's just only when. When some national disaster comes, And suddenly, there's panic across the country. The churches are set now to press forward, asking that we get back seriously to God. You understand that it's all set up. It's ready to go. That's going to be the cry. We've got to get back to God if we're going to stop these disasters. And it won't take long after that to push forward a Sunday law. We're moving there. You understand that, don't you? We're not just making up theories. We're almost there. We've got to ask ourselves, how am I doing? Will I be able to go through these difficult times? I don't have the faith today of a martyr. I don't have that exact same faith that I had back then as a teenager. I am promised, though, the faith that I need will be given to me. But I need to do my homework. I don't know if you've studied lately Matthew 25, the ten foolish Adventists that were virgins. They were all church members. And they all had a degree of relationship. But only five of them had done this kind of introspective homework that impressed them to have more oil. Do you understand? And so when push comes to shove, when the overwhelming surprise came and the bridegroom was delayed, the ones who had not laid the groundwork were unprepared. When I first, as a young Christian, heard that parable, I thought that was selfish of those people. Why didn't they share their oil? Well, I didn't know better. You can't share the Holy Spirit. You have to get it direct. So you can't get it all of a sudden. And so it behooves us that no matter how God has brought you to where you are, I mean, my experience was singular. The way that chaplain addressed me, the way the executive officer got me this job, what it provided for me, that's my story. But you have a story. And you have an experience that need to keep alive. And we need more wise virgins to go all the way. Christians, Prophets and Kings says, Christians should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise. And this preparation they should make by diligently studying the Word of God. See the preparation? And striving to conform their lives to these precepts. We need the fruits. God calls for a revival and a reformation. That's how we get this spare oil that will carry us through delays, disappointments, and overwhelming surprises. Jesus said in Revelation 3:5, "He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father, before the angels. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." It's such a privilege for me to be a Seventh-day Adventist Christian. I believe with all my heart we're part of the remnant church of Bible prophecy. I believe God's going to show this. We know that the Lord is going to take the church through. It's just, are we going to be part of it? None of us are here at Heartland by accident. You don't get to Heartland by accident. You have to choose to drive out here and find it and be here. So you're special people to me. And I just believe that God is looking for us to be part of His army. Mm-hmm. Supporting work, we used to call ourselves self-supporting work. Then we changed it to supporting ministries. Because we were trying to give a message that we're not just independent people, that we believe in pressing together to finish the work. I know not everything is okay in the church. Not everything's perfect in our institutions either. But we need to push together, press together, deal with problems. But at this time, let's not get sidetracked just before we get across the promised land. So let us learn a lesson from the foolish virgins and be wise Adventist virgins, and get the oil that we need. And let's press forward. In my struggle to find the Lord anew, He was there. And after I went through that experience, He's taught me new concepts. He's taught me about true education. There's things, of course, I would do differently if I could have repeated that. But He saw me through that. And He spared me from being lost. until he could educate me further in the ways of the Lord. And I'm just saying that to you. He will do that for you also, you know, in one way or another. Let us press together, and by God's grace, in the end of time, none of us will need to be lost. Let's finish the work together, is my prayer. Would you pray that with me as we kneel? Thank you for the privilege of coming together at the beginning of the Sabbath, and to be able to praise you and to share the life of a simple person who really got a bad start in so many different ways, like so many others do too. Satan has done so much to mess people up today and mess up families. But Lord, I'm so thankful that you're always reaching out to us. If we'll just listen and open our hearts, you're there. And I just praise you for your intervention in my own life. And you help me through mistakes that I made, and were so patient with me and kind and gentle, and brought me to the loving Savior and gave me a new life and a new family, the family of God. I'm so grateful for it for all eternity. I'm thankful for the wife you gave me, the children that have come along, that we could raise for your glory. But now that we're so close and very difficult times are upon us, are coming upon us like we've never seen before, it will seem like an overwhelming surprise. Will we be able to stand the storm? And I believe, Lord, this is the preparation time. This is where we need to get this extra oil and be filled with your Spirit, pressed together. As we bow before you, I pray this for all my brothers and sisters here, that they too will take this call to reach out, not cool off, press together. And if there's anything in our lives that needs to be dealt with, that we'll be willing to give that up now and look forward to eternity with you, is my prayer. In Jesus' name.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's Word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.